is brought to you by Head Start Basketball.
He outworked everybody, too. Not only was he more talented than anybody ever at Davidson, but I think he worked harder than anybody at Davidson. He was always like the first guy in the gym, the last guy to leave, but nobody knew what he was going to be. And that's sort of the birth of Stephen Curry and the start of his rise.
Terrell Ivory is the boys basketball head coach at Phillips Academy Andover in Massachusetts. He has served as the head coach since 2012, taking over the program from which he graduated in 2000. T.I. began his coaching career at Blair Academy as an assistant basketball coach and math teacher. After leaving Blair, he served 3 seasons as an assistant coach at Davidson, where he worked for his college coach, Bob McKillop, and had the opportunity to work with Steph Curry. From there, Ivory moved on to Colgate University, where he worked for Matt Langle for 1 season, before returning to Andover. T.I. played his college basketball at Davidson, where he was a 4-year letterman who played in 67 games. He played professionally in England for 1 season before beginning his coaching career. Hey, Hoopheads, start this school year off strong with up to $4,000 off Dr. Dish basketball shooting machines. Huge back-to-school savings with Dr. Dish, up to $4,000 off their professional shooting machine lineup. Dr. Dish Basketball is here to help you make this school year the best yet with exclusive offers on their All-Star Plus, Rebel Plus, and CT Plus shooting machines, all designed to give your team the ultimate training experience. Learn more at drdishbasketball.com and follow their incredible content at Dr. Dish B-Ball on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and YouTube. Mention the Hoopheads podcast and save an extra $300 on the Dr. Dish Rebel, All-Star, and CT models. That's a great deal, Hoopheads. Get your Dr. Dish shooting machine today.
Hi, this is Phil White, author of The Leader's Mind, and you're listening to the Hoopheads podcast.
Prepare like the pros with the all-new Fast Draw and Fast Scout. Fast Draw has been the number one play diagramming software for coaches for years. You'll quickly see why Fast Model Sports has the most compelling and intuitive basketball software out there. For a limited time, Fast Model is offering Hoopheads listeners 15% off Fast Draw and Fast Scout. Just use the code HHP15 at checkout to grab your discount, and you'll be on your way to more efficient game prep and improved communication with your team. Fast Model also has new coaching content every week on its blog, plus play and drill diagrams on its playbank. Check out the links in the show notes for more. Fast Model Sports is the best in basketball. Make sure you have pen and paper as you listen to this episode with Terrell Ivory, boys basketball head coach at Phillips Academy Andover in the state of Massachusetts. Hello and welcome to the Hoopheads podcast. It's Mike Klintzing here with my co-host Jason Sunkel tonight. And we are pleased to be joined by Terrell Ivory, head boys basketball coach at Andover Academy. T.I., welcome to the Hoopheads pod.
Thank you so much for having me, guys.
Thrilled to have you on. Looking forward to diving into all the things that you've been able to do in your basketball career. Let's start by going back in time to when you were a kid. Tell me a little bit about some of your first experiences with the game.
Yeah, it's one of those things. I think about it all the time. I've been playing as long as I can remember. I was lucky enough to have parents who sort of knew the value of being involved in athletics. I had a older brother who's 3 years older than me he's a mentor. I look up to him. He's an amazing person and he was a really good student athlete that I looked up to. So I think I was playing, you know, you pick up a ball and you're just messing around. And then I think, you know, my first organized sort of time playing basketball was around 5 years old, but we had a hoop in our hallway, an infamous hoop in our hallway, and my parents were okay with us making noise because we were doing something constructive, and we were banging into the walls and trying to we couldn't dribble because we didn't it was carpet in the hallway, but we could try to dunk on each other or shoot jumpers and then you had to sort of shoot with no arc because it would hit the ceiling. So I just remember doing that. So I've been playing basketball for a long time and been involved in a lot of different sports for a long time. But basketball was always my first love.
When you think about yourself as you get a little bit older and you're getting towards the high school years, how did you go about, as you took the game more seriously, what did you do to get better and improve? How'd you work on your game?
So I talked about my older brother. He was 3 years older than me. And as you know, as a younger sibling, you always want to, you know, hang out with them, you know, be friends with their friend. I think playing against older people, playing against his friends, playing against really good competition always helped make me better. And then it was, you know, having a sibling meant like you always had. So I rebounded for him. I got a chance to sort of watch him sort of figure out how he could get better and get shots up and things like that. And we played a lot of 21. Eventually we graduated from the hoop in our house in the hallway to a hoop in our, my dad put up a makeshift hoop in the backyard. And so we would play out there a lot of 21, and we had, I lived in a great neighborhood. And we also, you know, people would come over to our house and play, but we also would go to the park, and play every once in a while. And it was, you know, sort of what old people talk about when you go to the park and if you don't win, you got to sit out. And so, that was a great experience for me, but, I also had great coaches too, right? I played AAU. And at the time I was growing up, there were two teams, right? It was like the essence of AAU, right? The Amateur Athletic Union. There were two teams in Charlotte. And it was the Charlotte Sonics, they were the Charlotte Sonics first, and then they became the Charlotte Nets. And then they were the enemy because I played for the Charlotte Royals. And those were the two teams in Charlotte. And so my brother played for the Royals, so I ended up playing for the Royals. And that was sort of, you know, my journey. And that's how we got better. Like, in order to make that team, I knew I had to work really hard on my game outside of, like, the AAU season, including, like, playing for, you know, whatever league teams I was playing for, club teams I was playing for, and then, you know, the YMCA. And all those things. So I tried to play as much basketball as possible and outside of like organized basketball, but also, you know, in those leagues that my parents were sort of lucky. I was so lucky that they wanted me to play in those leagues and sign me up for everything and camps and things like that. So
obviously things were a lot different in terms of working with trainers, which didn't exist back in the day when you're talking about when you were playing. And
yeah.
And so you think about obviously playing pickup. And as you said, I'm one of those old guys that fondly remembers the days of playing pickup basketball. And I always like to say that for me, I always feel like I grew up in an era that I'm glad I did. And not that I wouldn't have enjoyed the way the game is today, but I really enjoyed the way I grew up, where I was either working on my game kind of by myself, or I was playing pickup basketball, or just like you, AAU was, I mean, I don't even know if we called it AAU back when I was playing in the late 80s, early 90s, but it was the same thing. Like here in Cleveland, there were maybe two teams of kids that were playing AAU basketball. And so it was a completely different feel than what it's like today. So how much did you balance out working on your game, maybe with your brother, by yourself, doing, I guess, skill development, for lack of a better word? You probably weren't calling it then, but just working on your game by yourself versus playing and doing some pickup and the AAU stuff that you already described. How'd you balance those two?
Yeah, because I don't want to sound like an old guy who says that, you know, I walked up, walked back and forth up a hill through snow and all that stuff. It was, and I'm not saying one is better than the other, right? It's different,
right?
And as a coach now, as a mentor now, as a person who sort of exists in the basketball world, right? Like, you gotta sort of deal with the way things are now, but it just was different back in the day. Like, it, you know, we played video games, but it wasn't like it is now, right? You know, I think I had a Nintendo or a Sega Genesis and or something like that. So I played video games and stuff like that, but like, it just wasn't the way it was now, because you had to plug it into a wall, right?
Right.
Like it was different. Now, like, kids just have people just have so much more access to to different things in a good way, but those things can also be distractions. There was much fewer distractions when I was growing up, right? And there was a lot of times, right? My parents were like, yo, you got to get out of the house. You got to go do something. And it got to the point where they weren't begging me to get out of the house anymore because I knew, like, all right, this is, you know, I got to stay busy. I did my, and my parents were like educators, right? And so academics always came first. And my brother and I were both good students. But once we got our work done, like the majority of the time I spent, if it wasn't, you know, was playing sports and mostly basketball, right? And so even when my brother, you know, wasn't around, and he was around most of the time, like I knew I could just go, you know, I was throwing the ball to myself, right? You spin it to yourself and you work on your game, you do some dribbling stuff. And we didn't have a gun, right? And I love the gun. I think it's great. But when my kid, like the gun, at my school, you know, we had to get it fixed. And my kids would complain. I'm like, coach, you can't go shoot. I was like, yes, you can go shoot. Just get somebody else to rebound for you. And then you rebound for them, right? Like there are ways for you to get shots up without like a machine throwing you the ball back. And a lot of it was, there wasn't as much skill development, like you said. A lot of it was just you were playing. Right. And then again, at the park, and one of my coaches, Coach McKillop, talked about this all the time. But like at the park, right, that's where you sort of got better. Right. And there was pressure on you to win, because depending on, and there were a lot of people at the park on the weekends, at least. So if you didn't win, right, you set out. And because I was smaller, like I had to figure out a way to stay on the court. And for me, playing against older players, right? If I tried to score, then I wasn't going to be as effective as if I tried to like help my teammates score, right? So that sort of, you know, and I played college basketball, and I'm not saying I was, you know, I know who I am, right? But I did play a pretty high level college basketball. But I always remember I was like when I wanted to, when I was playing with older people, like scoring wasn't how I was going to stay on the court. It was making sure that other people got the ball, right? Even when I lost, they were like, "I want him." Right?
he's gonna pass me the ball.
Right, exactly. Right? Yeah, I was like, yeah. So I was trying to always figure out winning was the best way to stay on the court, right? But you weren't going to always win. And so another way to stay on the court, I figured out pretty early on, playing against better competition and older guys, was to make sure that I made them happy by passing them the ball, right?
So yeah, that is so true. I mean, it's funny. It's one of the things that I think kids do miss out on today, is that you don't ever have to kind of figure out, well, what's my role and how do I get myself onto this team? And I always tell the story, like when I first started going to the park near my house when I was a kid, I was probably, I don't know, maybe 13, something like that. And so I made sure that I was always, to get on the court, I was always the first guy there. So when the first 10 guys rolled up, I was in that first game. And then I was always the last guy to leave, so I could always get in that last game. And then in between, obviously, you got to try to win and weasel your way onto teams and whatever you got to do when you're a young guy. And I just think that that's something that, again, when I look back on it, just like you said, I don't think that the system back then was better or worse necessarily than the system that we have today. I just know my experience was one that I wouldn't trade for anything. Just the idea of being at the park and playing with guys of all different ages and all those different kinds of things, I feel like that really made me the player who I was. And also it helped me develop, I think, as a person. You develop confidence, the ability to speak up and stand up for yourself and all the things that kind of go along with playing with people of all different ages. Whereas again, kids today kind of miss out on some of that because you're always playing with your own age group and you got to coach there and you got mom and dad in the stands and all that stuff. So it's just interesting how different things are today, for sure. All right, so tell me a little bit about the decision. You're in Charlotte and you end up at Andover. How does that happen?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so my older brother is going to be sort of a running theme in this conversation because he's an unbelievable person, but I don't want him to hear me say this if he listens to this podcast. But I love him to death, and I looked up to him, so I wanted to do everything that he did. My mom and my dad both really valued education. My dad's mother was a teacher, and his father was a pastor. But my mom's parents, right, neither one of them went to college. So, you know, my dad had a sort of different way of valuing education, but my mom in particular, like, she just wanted us to have better opportunities than her parents had and better opportunities than she had. So Titus, my older brother, was a really good basketball player, really good football player, at a really good school, public school in North Carolina called NorthMet. And that's where I went to school as well. His 11th grade year, he started getting some interest from a lot of schools. He had some, at the time, some smaller schools that were recruiting him from like what we say, low major conferences, right? Low to mid major conferences. I'm thinking Davidson was one of those schools, right? When they were in the Southern Conference and Coach McKillop recruited them like crazy. UNC Charlotte was in the Sun Belt at the time. They were recruiting him. And then a lot of schools. So he had scholarship offers and had some good opportunities. Wake Forest was messing around a little bit. Dave Odom would come and see him play a lot. But the big schools, the schools who were most involved were like Davidson and UNC Charlotte. At some point, Titus committed to UNC Charlotte. This is when they were about to move to Conference USA. And Melvin Watkins, who was a coach there at the time. I think that's his name. Melvin Watkins was a coach there at the time. So Titus committed to UNC Charlotte. After he committed, I think over the summer, my mom talked to a family friend who had sent their kids to Phillips Academy Andover. And my mom was like intrigued by the reputation of the school, and then learned more about how he could develop not only as a student, but also as an athlete. The guy's name was Charlie Pittman. Charlie Pittman played at Penn State, played football at Penn State for Joe Paterno. And his son also played football at Penn State. And his son went to Andover and played football at Penn State. Titus, you know, he played in the East-West All-Star game in North Carolina. He played pretty well. And other schools were reaching out to him saying, "Hey, we would love to recruit you." They had a conversation. My mom said, "Hey, I want you to apply to this school." He applied and got in, and I wasn't a part of this conversation, but my dad and my brother were like, "Hey, but he's committed to UNC Charlotte, so he has to go." And my mom was like, "I'll take care of that," right?
Mom will take care of it, so, right?
Yeah, she's like, "I'll take care of that." So she called the coach and said, "Hey, he's not coming, right? He's going to this school." And the coach, I don't know what that conversation was like, but what I do know is my mom was like, she understood like how, even before she knew as much as she knows now about the place, right, she understood like what this would do to sort of change the trajectory of his life going to a school like Andover, even without the basketball, right? He came up here, and I always joke around because my brother is, so I'm 6 feet when that's what I write.
On
right?
your best, in, on your best day, you're 6 feet.
Yeah, yeah. I'm 6 feet. I'm not 6 feet, but like in the Davidson catalog or whatever we did. Like I put like 6 feet. Sometimes I can get away with writing 6'1", right? My brother is legit like 6'4", 6'5", right? And like built like a tank, right? And I always talk about like how unfair it was that like he was like 4 inches taller than me, right? So I will admit this. He is a much better athlete than I am. What I always say is like, I'm way smarter than he is, right? So he committed to, for a post-grad year, committed to go to, basically said, yeah, okay, my mom figured out how to get him to go to Phillips Academy Andover. And then he came up here for the summer session. And it was really, really challenging for him, right? So this is the part where I told him I'm smarter than him, because when I came to Phillips Academy, they didn't ask me to go to the summer session, right? Like I was good, right? So that was a part of like, all right, you can come, but based on like what you've done academically, like you need to go to summer session just to prepare. And he got up here and he was like, yeah, this is really, really challenging. And almost to the point where he was like, I don't know if I can do this. He figured out a way to get through the summer session. And then he came to the school and absolutely killed it in a lot of different ways. Right. He played football. They won a NEPSAC championship. And he like, there's this infamous story about against our rival Phillips Exeter, where, you know, they were down 3-0 and they threw a pass and the Andover threw a pass and time expired, incomplete pass, time expired. But the referees put time back on the clock. They were on like the 10-yard line, right? This is the short version. So with 1 second left, he caught like a fade pass in the end zone to win the game. And so at first, when time expired, the Exeter fans rushed the field. and they were like, and the referees like, you got to get off the field. We got one more play. And then he caught the pass. And then the Andover fans rushed the field because that ended the game. And so he had a great football season. And then in basketball, at that time, I don't know how much you know about the NEPSAC, but right now it's split up into classes, right? It's NEPSAC. There's A, double A, and then triple A. And then there's smaller, like there's BC. But like NEPSAC is a really good league. But at that time, there were no classes, right? So Andover would play against. So we don't play against Brewster right now because they're a triple A team, right? And we do play against Worcester, who's a double A team, but we only play like four of those games. Whereas most of the teams we play are in our class, right? Which is based on the population of boys at the school. But at that time, they were playing against like Bridgeton Academy, MCI. I think Rashad McCants went to MCI, Ed Cota went to MCI, and I may have that, but those were dudes there, right? And so Titus was at this school where the academic standards were really high, right? And they went like 21-3, right? And had a really good year, averaged like 30 points a game. So that year, Davidson was still recruiting them. Obviously, UNC Charlotte was still recruiting them. But the three schools who were on him really hard after he came here and had a really good fall were Penn State, Michigan State, Indiana, and Notre Dame wanted them for football and basketball, right? So like that, if it was just about basketball, it worked, right? His recruiting sort of changed from looking at like some smaller schools in North Carolina and some low major, mid major to him being able to go to Penn State and having an unbelievable career at Penn State, right? So when it came time for me, to when I graduated from North Mac, right, I wasn't getting much interest. I was looking at some D3 schools. Like Roanoke was the highest level basketball school that was looking for me, right? And so when it came time for me to apply to colleges, my mom was like, "You should go to Andover too," right? She basically told me I was going there, and she was my mom. I trusted her. And you know, she had always looked out for me. And so I really didn't even apply to any colleges. So I ended up at Phillips Academy Andover. And again, it didn't work out like basketball wise the way it worked out for Titus, right? Bobby Knight didn't come see me play Davidson. I was right in the backyard. They weren't recruiting me, right? And I played AAU that extra year, and I remember Davidson coming to watch me play, but they didn't offer me a scholarship. And so when I left, I know you asked me about Andover. When I left Andover, right, the schools that were recruiting, I went to visit Amherst, I went to visit Williams. And then I made the decision to give myself an opportunity to play at Davidson. And part of that was, I watched Coach McKillop recruit my brother. I watched Coach Matheny, who was the assistant coach at Davidson, you know, recruit my brother. And one of the reasons I wanted to go back home is, like, in between, when I was 17, my father passed away. So I felt like I needed to be closer to home, to be closer to my mom. Yep. Right. And one of the things I always say is that when Titus like broke Coach McKillop's heart, right? And I know as a college coach, like there are a lot of kids you recruit that don't end up coming to your school. But man, Coach McKillop recruited Titus like really, really hard, to the point where I remember him flying up to, Titus told me the story of him flying up to Andover. Right before he made the decision to go to Penn State. But even after Titus sort of, you know, I went on some of the recruiting visits to Davidson, with Titus, and I was like, I'll come here. Right.
sign me up.
But they were like, nope. I watched him and I saw like who he, I kind of got a feel for who he was. And the thing that sort of, when I was saying like, hey, I want to go back home, I want to try to play at Davidson. Like the thing I remember is I was sitting in the church at my dad's funeral in the front row, right? You know, obviously sad, heartbroken, not able to sort of deal with that as a 17-year-old, but you know, Coach McKillop came to the funeral. This was at least a year or two after Titus had said no to him. So, you know, for me, I was like, if I'm going to go play for somebody, like I get to choose now who I want to try to play for. Like I want to play for somebody who would show up at my dad's funeral, even after my brother decided not to play for him. Right. Why, after watching him recruit him the way that he did, right? Because he was on another level compared to, I think, all the other coaches. Obviously not like not Penn State because he chose to go there, but to me that meant something, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think when you start talking about people who have a huge impact on your life, like it sounds like you were able to recognize early on that, man, Coach McKillop's going to be a guy that if I can go there and be a part of the team and, you know, be under his tutelage for 4 years, the things that you're going to come out of that with, not only on the basketball floor, but just as a human being, I can see where you're already starting to, again, almost not that you were even processing it like this, but I almost think you're thinking of that, like as an adult, like this guy is a mentor. This is a guy who is going to have an impact on me, not only on the basketball floor, but off the basketball floor, and kind of seeing that through the recruitment of your brother. So what's the conversation like when you're making that decision, where obviously most people that are recruiting you at that point, you know, you're not getting those Division I looks, you're not having a wide variety of choices. So when you go and you have a conversation with Coach McKillop and you say, hey, I want to come to Davidson, what's that conversation sound like? What do you remember about it?
Yeah, the conversation wasn't with Coach McKillop. Like at that point, right? They weren't recruiting, but I had done well enough academically to apply to the school and to get into the school. My ticket into the school was football, right? So I had a plan. right? And I'm not saying, like, in retrospect, it makes a lot of sense. I would say, like, I wouldn't, and I have conversations with my players all the time about making sure that they find the right fit, right? And I, as a young kid, I probably thought I was better than I was, right? What I did know is I worked really hard, and I loved basketball. And so I figured I would take the risk, right? I don't know if I would recommend that to kids, or I would make sure that they know, like, you may not right. make the team there, yeah. right? You may not play basketball ever again. Like, are you willing to give up basketball to go to a Division I school as opposed to go to a William and Amherst where they really, really want you, right? So, like, I've had this conversation with kids all the time, and I get to tell them, you know, my story and say, sometimes I wish that maybe I would have given myself the chance to go to, like, a Williams or an Amherst, right? That's really good basketball. It's really good basketball. It's a really good school. It just worked out for me. So in retrospect, I made the right decision. And I didn't play as much as I wanted to play. But like the experience is something that I will never, ever, ever say that like I loved my experience there. And part of it was because of Coach McKillop. So my conversation was more, with once I got into the school and the football team, the football coach was recruiting me, right? So once I got into the school, I called Coach Matheny and said, hey, Coach Matheny, I'm coming to Davidson, right? And I would love to try out for the basketball team. And Coach Matheny is my guy, right? And he's done so much for me. But at the time, he was like, all right, you can try out. That was it.
He didn't do any cartwheels, is that what you're saying?
No, he wasn't. Part of me was like, oh, they're mad. I was like, so Coach McKean, just so you know, like, I told you I would come. Titus is the one who went to Penn State, right? But like, but at the time, he was like, all right, you can try out. And so I played football. When I got there, so that sort of started right away. I went in the preseason, I played football, but I would always just show up because they were doing like, at the time, the way they could work out was a little bit different. They could do like 3-4 man workouts, right? In the preseason. So I would just go and just sit in the gym and watch them work out. I had some conversations with Coach, but they didn't make me any promises. There was no guarantee. And this was the first time I was a good athlete in high school. Right. When you start playing like 15, 16, 17 and under AAU, at that point, you kind of know, right, you're going to make the team. Right. So I didn't have to deal with that pressure. This was the first time in a long time where I was like, I don't know if I'll ever play basketball again. Like it was stressful. So I was, you know, I was going to football practice, right, which was always like a grind. I was doing my work. And then I would get in the gym when they weren't using the court and work out and do everything I can to sort of be ready to give myself a chance. And I don't remember much of tryouts, but part of it was just like, all right, we got one walk-on who was on the team last year. There's another kid who's trying out. Like, you just got to play them one-on-one, right? So, that's tough, right? And then eventually, I put myself in a position where they said, all right, you can be a part of the team, but, like, there's no guarantees whatsoever. By the time I made the team, and then I was like – I was like, I'm done with football, right? Because I remember watching I was still playing football. They played Duke early in the season. I was thinking it was in like November. So I was watching that game in my dorm room, right? Because I wasn't a part of the team yet. And then I would say like, you know, a few weeks later, I was a part of the team. But I don't think I was traveling with the team or anything like that. But I was they were allowing me to practice, and I was a part of the team, and it was sort of like, it felt like I was like, they could just be like, all right, you're done at any point. Right. But like what I knew, right. And it was sort of similar to when I was playing pickup as a kid, is like, all right, like I got to figure out a way to make sure they know that they need me. Right. And part of it was just, I was going to do everything I could to make sure I was competing and making the guys who were playing, making sure I made sure that they got better. Right. I was going to play hard defense to the point where I was annoying. I'm sure I was annoying to the guys who played. Like, why is he playing? So
why is this walk-on bothering me, man? Get this guy off me.
Why is this walk-on? Yeah. Get him away from me. Right. But my whole thing was, all right, I'm gonna do my best to make you guys better, right? And like that's what I tried to do. I had to sort of it was a very humbling thing, right? Because I was no longer like it didn't matter at that point. It's like my mindset was, it doesn't matter how good I play. Like I'm not gonna get to play because a scholarship is worth something, right? I'm free. And so like, I just got to do what I can to make sure that these other guys get better. And then like, as much as they didn't like me, because I think I was playing, like I was going way too hard. Right. I wanted to make sure they liked me off the court. And so that was part of it too, is I think I have a good personality. So that part was sort of natural and easy, but, I was relieved when I finally didn't feel like, all right, they're going to cut me at any point, right? I don't even know at what point. I can't remember at what point that was, but like at some point, like I was on the team and I felt like, okay, yeah, I'm okay, right? I don't have to like fight for my life anymore. But Coach McKillop, once I got to know him, like it was tough, right? It was tough. But you could tell, like, he was, and I had a lot of really good coaches growing up and some coaches who weren't so good. He was unbelievable, right? Like I just had so much respect for him, and sort of like how he ran his practices and how he was sort of went about making sure that we got better. And then it was just the details, right? And then at a certain point I realized like he's teaching us a lot about basketball, but he's also teaching us a lot about like life, right? And preparing us for, you know, what things will be like after we finish playing basketball, which I really appreciate it, especially for a person who, you know, whose father had passed away, right? So
what's your favorite memory from your time at Davidson? Does one thing stick out? Maybe on the court, off the court, in the locker room, is there any one or two things that stick out for you?
Yeah, going to the NCAA tournament. I think 2002. So my sophomore year, we won the Southern Conference tournament. We beat Furman in the championship, and I don't think it was a close game. But you know, like, college basketball is no joke. And all the sort of work that we put in, all the sacrifices, all, you know, a lot of good, some bad, right? But it's sort of, for us, like that was it, right? That was what you sort of fought for, was sort of winning the Southern Conference Championship and having a chance to play in the NCAA tournament. And I had watched that growing up. I watched my brother play in the tournament, and being able to have that experience where we're sitting in what we call the union at the time, watching Selection Sunday, and seeing our name come on the screen against, I think we were 13 seed and we played the 4 seed. We played Ohio State. We played out in New Mexico in the pit, and that experience was really cool. And actually it was a pretty close game, And I got in the game.
So not only did you make the NCAA tournament, but you played in the NCAA tournament.
I played. Look, so my because I had no expectations of playing, but I played a little bit my sophomore year. And one of my best friends on the team at the time, this kid, Wayne Bernard, was a starting point guard. And he was my guy and was a really, really good player from San Diego. And so it was always for me, there was always this conflict, right? Because I wanted him to do well because he was my really good friend. And I loved him. But like I knew when he got two fouls, coach was gonna put me in. So I'm on the bench, like, and I'm cheering and I'm up and I'm doing everything I can to support my teammates. But when he got his first foul, like there was always this voice in the back of my head, like you might want to
reach in right there and try to get a steal.
So I was always at that point. Like most games, I was sort of first off the bench when he got two fouls, and so I knew I was going to go in too. At some point, I was like, I'm just going to sub myself in, coach, when he gets two fouls. That game was unbelievable, right? We had a chance, and it was a close game. I got in the game, and I think I had one turnover, and then I think he took me out. Like I think I played like 3 minutes. And so as much as I would sub myself in the game when I had when Wayne had two fouls, I knew when I had that turnover, I was like, yeah, come get me.
my time here is done.
Yeah.
That's funny. I mean, getting an opportunity to play in the NCAA tournament. I mean, again, like it's. You think about how much time you spend as a young kid just growing up. And as you said, you got to watch your brother play, but just watching on TV and thinking about playing in it at some point. And when I was playing at Kent, my freshman year, and that year, that was the only year I didn't play a lot. I played probably, I don't know, 5 minutes a game maybe, but we made it to the tournament, the MAC tournament final. And we lost by one. And that's a case where I was a freshman and, you know, we had a pretty good team and thought, hey, you know, we're going to be back in this position and be able to, you know, we didn't make it. We lost by one in the tournament final. And, you know, being somebody who plays 5 minutes, you were kind of like, yeah, you know, I would have liked to have made it, but man, you know, when we make it in the next couple of years, when I'm really playing, it's going to be, you know, a lot different. And then obviously we never got there. And so it's one of those things that, you know, man, just to be able to have that opportunity to experience that, something that you've watched and seen, and it's been a part of your life since you were a little kid to be able to participate in that. I'm sure it was obviously, as you just described, super special to be able to do that. When you're there at Davidson, what did you go into your college career academically thinking about in terms of what you wanted to study and what your career was going to be? Did you think you were going to be a coach, or where were you at? Where was your mindset at as you were going through school?
Yeah, so I mean, like most kids growing up, I wanted to be a doctor or a lawyer, and as I got older, that sort of changed. I knew I wanted to be involved in sports at some point, right? I just didn't know how. So I thought about sports medicine. I thought about like sports marketing or something like that. I got to Davidson and took a couple of like science, biology classes. I was like, I'm not doing that anymore, right? I think one of my superpowers, I think, right, is self-awareness, right? I just wasn't like a big fan of those classes, right? And I was like, I'm not doing this. And so I ended up majoring in sociology, and it's a liberal arts school. So you took a little bit of everything. So I ended up majoring in sociology. And I had no idea what I wanted to do. I just knew I wanted to be involved in basketball. And then what happened is the more and more, as I got older and the more and more, like I learned from Coach McKillop, I was like, listen, I want to be a coach, right? And because I wasn't playing as much, I really could sort of step back and just take in everything that he was doing and understand like why he made certain decisions and really pay attention to what was happening and what sort of his mindset was and how he was preparing us not only for games but again for the other things that probably matter even more than competing. He inspired me. And he became like a role model. He became a mentor. And I knew, like, especially my junior, senior year, like I want to coach and just trying to figure out how I could do that. I always sort of had this dream of playing. I played like maybe 15 minutes my junior year. And then that went down my senior year. I didn't play as much my senior year. I still played a little bit, but not as much. Other kids from the school had played overseas. My brother was playing like really high level overseas. So at first I was like, all right, I want to play as long as I can. I ended up playing 1 year. Coach got me a job in England playing basketball for a club called the Manchester Magic. And again, the self-awareness, right? I was making like $1,500 to like $2,000 a month, right? Which was enough, right? But
that wasn't a long-term career.
No, it wasn't a long-term career. Whereas my brother, he was making, he was making like exponentially more money, right? And so I had somebody to sort of compare myself to. And I was like, listen, if I was making what he was making, then maybe I would continue to do this. And so at that point, I made the decision, like, all right, I want to get into coaching. And again, I use like my relationships with Coach McKillop and at the time Coach Matheny. And I sort of let them know, like, hey, I wanted to get into coaching. Coach Matheny heard from Coach Mantegna at Blair Academy. He was like, this is what I'm looking for. And Coach Matheny was like, I got the guy, right? He was looking for a young guy who wanted to get into coaching and who wanted to get into college coaching at some point, right? And this opportunity to work at a boarding school. So I was playing, but I knew that wasn't gonna last. I had gone to a boarding school, so Blair Academy, where Coach Mantegna worked, was a similar school to Phillips Academy. So I kind of understood what that world was. And Coach Matheny hooked me up with Coach Mantegna. And I remember talking to him over the summer about the opportunity. And it's funny because I had just played, I was working a basketball camp, and there was a kid who was, I think he was on his way to college. Because there was some opportunities, right? Some like low level opportunities in Europe. But I played one on one against this kid. His name was Anthony Morrow. And he absolutely destroyed me. And I was like, yeah, I'm done with basketball. I was like, I can't, there's nothing I could do. Right. And I was like, that's like a bad. And I, at that time, I didn't know he was going to play in the NBA. I think he went to Georgia Tech. But like he absolutely destroyed me. So that made me even more like, all right, I'm going to go into coaching because I'm done with basketball because I can't do that. Right. And so he connected me with Coach Mantegna and that was that opportunity that became like, unbelievable sort of jumping off point for me to get into college coaching. So one of the things I always tell, my players is, and one of the reasons why I love working here and helping kids have this opportunity is they develop relationships, right? And those relationships matter. And, you know, when I was at Davidson, when I wasn't playing as much as I wanted to, I was good with it. My mom wasn't.
You had to try to keep mom quiet.
my mom was like, I don't know if Coach McKillop even knows this, but my mom was like, I'm going to go talk to Coach McKillop. I was like, no, you're not. It's like, no, you're not. And I said it. And my mom, she is, to use a good word, she's passionate, right? And loves her baby because I'm her baby, right? But she just didn't understand why I wasn't playing. And I talked about how I thought I was a little bit better than I was. She thought I was way better than Coach McKillop thought I was. And I said to her, I was like, and I had to like talk her down. I was like, you are not going to go talk to Coach McKillop. And I said, and this is how I convinced her not to go talk to Coach McKillop. I said, like, he cares about me and I know I'm not playing and it hurts. I want to play. But I know he cares about me. And I know, right, that he cares about me and he cares about the team. And maybe we think I'm better than I am, but like he's doing what's best for this team. And here's what I know, right? He's gonna be there for me for a long time after I graduate from Davidson. He's always gonna help me out. Like I knew that. Right. And he showed us that like everything at Davidson was about family from like, you know, everything we did. And this sort of the mantra that we had, the thing that we tapped when we left the locker room was trust, commitment, care. Right. And I trusted him. I knew like, yeah, I know he knows that I want to play. Right. It's one of the reasons why I work so hard. I know he knows that I'm upset. But my job is to help this team get better, regardless of how much I play in the game. And if I play, like I'm going to do everything that I can to earn minutes. But like you are not allowed to talk to Coach McKillop. And my mom apologizes to me this day because Coach McKillop or Coach Matheny, Coach McKillop got me the job in England. Coach Matheny got me the job at Blair Academy with Coach Mantegna. I was there for 3 years. The first year at Blair Academy, after I played in England for a year, I was an intern and I was just an assistant coach. And I had a chance to, because they were a powerhouse back then, right? So there were so many college coaches coming in to watch those kids play. And Coach Mantegna, like his sole purpose was to help me get better as a coach and to mentor me, but also like to help me connect with coaches, right? So when Tom Crean came to watch one of our players play when he was at Marquette, right? I went and picked him up at the airport and brought him back to Blair Academy. It was like an hour ride, right? And I did that with other coaches. So I got a chance to meet a lot of coaches. Now I always joke with Coach Mantegna that like I got a job at Davidson, so I know you wanted to help me out, but clearly I didn't need you because I could have got that job without you. So, but like Coach Mantegna was like, and again, I'm so lucky that I had like these adults in my life. And going back to when I played at North Neck, like there was a guy, Leroy Holden, who was, you know, he was a legend. In Mecklenburg County in the Charlotte Huntersville area. And then I had a chance to play for a guy who's an unbelievable coach, still at North Mac, who has Dwayne Lewis, who's unbelievable. Right. So my senior year, he took over, for Coach Holden. And then, you know, I got Coach McKillop, and then I got a chance to work for Joe Mantegna, who it was amazing because I always thought he was like the one of the best coaches that I had ever been around. And the one thing he always did was ask questions, and he would ask me questions. And I'm like, you're the head coach. Like, why are you asking me? Like, but he really like, he wanted to know what I thought. And I was like, this is so cool. And so it made me want to like learn even more so I could be prepared to answer his questions and sort of help him, his program get better. But his program is really good, right? But he would always ask questions. And that's something that, that's one of the of many lessons that he taught me. But he would always ask questions. He would ask questions like as if I was as smart as him. I was like, I'm not smarter than you. You're like the guy. And then I got a chance to work for Coach McKillop, which, you know, so I thought I learned a lot from him as a player, but like seeing him, like the way he wrote practice plans, the way he sort of catered the practices to help us like learn certain skills. There was this thing we did before practice. They were called simulations, right? So we spent like the first 20 to 30 minutes in practices just doing like little small like movements and drills and things, sometimes even without a ball. And he was just creating these things. Like there would be a problem we needed to address or something we watched on film. And, you know, this kid, like we would call it pin boxing, right? Because everybody knows you box out. But like if you're on the outside and a shot goes up, like you want to push them under the basket, right? So we would work on stuff like that. It was like I'd learned so much from him as a coach, like how to write a practice plan, right? That's something like as simple as that. But like he's just I've been lucky, right? So I had Coach McKillop, and then I went from Davidson working there for 3 years. And Coach Lango was like just so different from Coach McKillop, but like learning from him, because his style was a little bit different, was just, it just made me so much better, right, as a coach. And so I one of the things I always say is I just been lucky, right? I've been lucky to be around like some unbelievable people, some unbelievable coaches, and you know, that's helped me, I think, you know, be a better coach, be a better mentor, and you know, it's got me to, yeah. And I'm still like Coach Mantegna. Like I'm constantly thinking, like I want to ask questions. I want to learn, right? And I think that's really important as a coach.
What was the transition like going from the player coach relationship with Coach McKillop to suddenly you're a part of his staff and your colleagues as opposed to that player coach? I know that it never goes away and he's always going to be Coach McKillop to you. I'm sure you weren't walking around the office calling him Bob, but just when did you start to feel comfortable with the idea that, hey, we've at least reached this equilibrium point where I'm not looking at him as my coach and I'm still a player in that relationship, and we are more colleagues, so to speak, when you're on his staff? How long did it take for you to kind of get comfortable with that?
Yeah, I think right away, because like one of the things that he was really good at was communication, and he sort of made me understand, like, we're bringing you back, like I want you to come back, we're bringing you back as a coach because we need your input, we value your input. You know, I played for him, so he watched me as a player, and I think he understood the way sort of I analyze a game, and I hope that he thought I was a high IQ player. And so when he brought me back, like the understanding was like, you're not here just because like we're doing you a favor. You're here because like we need your help. We want your input, and we want you to help out as much as possible. And so for me, it was an opportunity to learn and understand, like, and get a feel for what he needed and how I could help out the program. But he made it clear, like, you know, when we would meet, and we had a lot of meetings, when we would meet, like he would ask for input, and I was a director of basketball operations at the time. So like sort of on the totem pole of coaches, I was the lowest coach, but he made sure that I felt like, the input that I had, my value was important. And every once in a while you would say something, or like he would put it into practice when he like, yeah, you know, you pat yourself on the back, right?
You're like, hey, yeah, Terrell came up with something right here.
No, it was great. I love that. So yeah, he was, I mean, he just was great. He made you feel like you mattered. And that's really important, especially because he had such an unbelievable reputation, right? And like the way people sort of revered him in that community, you know, was something that I admired. But he always made us feel like we were important. As a player, he made us feel that way, and he made us feel that way as coaches. So I think right away, because he told me, he's like, you know, we're hiring you because I think you bring value to our program. So.
Yeah. No better endorsement of a great leader than somebody who takes input from all their people and makes all their people feel valued. I mean, I think anybody, no matter whether you're talking about a coach who's leading a basketball program, or you're talking about a CEO who's leading a company, or you're talking about a principal who's leading a school, right? If you can master that technique to make people feel like they're a part of it and that their input is valued, then you're 90% of the way there as far as what great leadership is really all about. Yeah.
Hey, Hoopheads Nation, whether you're a beginner basketball player looking for a place to start or a seasoned vet looking to level up your skills, I want to tell you about your new go-to secret weapon. It's called Train. Train is a basketball training and education platform that gives you on-demand access to premium basketball courses created by expert coaches and trainers from around the world. Want to get better at blowing by your defender? Learn setup drills with NBA and international pro trainer Marius Williams, or how to use the punch drag with NBA trainer Kerry Darting. Looking to level up your catch-and-shoot skills? Practice space shooting workouts with former lead female trainer for Kobe Bryant's Mamba League, San Dixon. Or if you're just starting out, learn the basics of shooting and finishing at the basket from international champion, three-time Romanian Player of the Year, and Train co-founder, Vlad Moldovaniu. Train has 32 and counting actionable, expert-led, on-demand basketball training courses that teach you exactly how to improve your ball handling, shooting, attacking, and more. For a limited time, Hoopheads listeners get 35% off monthly, annual, and lifetime plans. Just go to gotrainbasketball.com/hoopheads to learn more and sign up for a free 7-day trial.
You had an opportunity while you're at Davidson. I can't let it slide by that you had a pretty good player there at Davidson while you were coaching.
Yeah.
So tell me a little bit about just what it was like to be around Steph Curry when he's a college player at Davidson.
Yeah. So even before that, like I lived in Charlotte when Dell Curry was playing for the Hornets. I used to work Dell's camps. And so I used to watch Steph play, and his jumper was beautiful, but I just watched the documentary, but he did shoot from his hip. Right. And eventually he changed his shot. But like it looked good. I'll say this, like Dell used to do those shooting demonstrations where he would start like in close and then he would sort of gradually move back, and he would talk about the value of starting in close and then he would move back to the 3-point line. And then like, because it's sort of, you know, how Steph has changed the game. But Dell used to like go to half court. Right. And just shoot a jump shot. And it looked like he was like shooting a form shot, like right under the rim. Right.
And in his era, I will say, so Dell was in Cleveland while I was probably in high school.
Yeah.
And we went and saw them play in an exhibition game at the University of Akron.
Yeah.
And I mean, I saw their games at the old Coliseum in Richfield that the Cavs played. But I remember going to that game at Akron and just seeing him shoot the ball and the speed. I don't remember anybody from that era being able to get the shot off as fast as Dell Curry could get that shot off. And that, when I think of Dell Curry, that's the main thing that I think about, is just the speed of his release. And I still have, it's one of those memories that's kind of like seared into my brain of, I can still see like where I was sitting in that game at the University of Akron. And just, I have like one picture of him raising up for a jump shot. And the thing that always stuck in my head from that game was, man, does that guy get the shot off quick?
Yeah, he was. It was one of those things where it was just different, right? Watching him shoot and like,
right?
How it seemed like he was so strong, but it looked just effortless, like when he shot it. Because I remember, like in college, I remember we in pro-ams, there would be a NBA 3-point line, and I think I had a really good jumper, but all of a sudden you're like heaving the ball from
right, you're trying to get yeah, it there exactly.
Right? Yep. So I used to watch Steph when he was like 11, 12 years old. And then my actual first coaching job was with the Charlotte Stars, and a friend of mine, his name is Malcolm Saunders. He goes by he used to run do a lot of parties in Charlotte. His name is Buck Long, which is how he got connected with Dell and started a AAU program. So I used to watch Steph play, but I coached Seth, right? So my first coaching job was coaching the younger team that Seth was on. So I coached his team. So I knew the family. My mom was on Dale Curry's like board, right? For like some charities he was running and stuff like that. So I knew the family, and I knew Steph, right? And watched him play a lot and sort of follow like his story, but nobody knew what he was going to be. So when I got to Davidson, they had just made it to the Elite Eight the year before, right? And so that was, you know, that sort of was everything, right? And that's sort of the birth of Steph and Curry and like sort of the start of his rise, right? To what he is now. But so when I was at Blair Academy, I almost got fired, because I went to the game in Detroit. My sister lives in Detroit, and they made it to, I think they were playing, it was a game that LeBron came to. They were playing Wisconsin. And I was like, I'm going to the game. And I was teaching at that point, I was teaching a class. And I basically like wrote my class and like, hey, no class, right? So I drove.
Watch T.I. on TV, man. We're supposed to have class. There he is at the game.
I drove 9 hours to the game. I stayed with my sister. I got tickets from, I called Coach Matheny. I was like, Coach, I'm coming to the game. He got me tickets. I was at the game. It was unbelievable. And then I got back to Blair Academy, and the dean of faculty was like, hey, T.I., you need to come into my office. It's like, and I was like, and he was the nicest guy ever. He basically was like, don't you ever do that again. And like, I got in trouble, but it was worth it, right? And so, long story short, Coach McKillop hired me the next year. And it was, you know, being around him was a little crazy, right? And this was, imagine if it was now, right? When there was like social media.
Right, absolutely.
But like every game was packed. But the best thing about Steph, and this is, I talk about, you know, being around his family, being around his mom, being around his dad. Like I always tell people, like, he's a really good player, right? He's a better person than he is a player. And that was the case at Davidson, right? Nobody, if you didn't know, like, he was an unbelievable basketball player. Like, it wasn't like he was walking around like, I'm the man. And, you know, and like, he was so accessible. Like, he cared about, you know, like using sort of, like the gravity that he had to help other people. But he also, you know, he's one of those kids. He outworked everybody too. Not only was he more talented than anybody ever at Davidson, but I think he worked harder than anybody at Davidson. He was always like the first guy in the gym, the last guy to leave. There were plenty of times he was like, you know, T.I., can you get in there? Can we shoot, you know, and stuff like that. But it was fun to watch, because as an alum, as a person who went to Davidson, who cared about the school, outside of being on the staff, right? It was cool to watch how many people gravitated towards him and gravitated towards the school because he was there, and because of the way he was playing, because of the things he was doing. And I watched him in practice. He was just unbelievable. He would just make crazy shots and do unbelievable things. But also on the road, right? Like I turned into his sort of de facto bodyguard, because he would never tell anybody no. Right. And so he got to the point, I was like, yo, we got to go, man. Like, because I was the ops guy. So I had to make sure the bus was on time. And like,
you got to get him where he's supposed to be. Right.
Yeah. I got it. So like we had sort of a thing where I was like, all right, we got to go, man. Like, I know you want to sign a million autographs, but we got to go. But like that, it was like he was a rock star at that point because of what he did the year before. And so people were like running up to our buses, and every game, obviously the Davidson games were sold out, but every game was sold out on the road too, right? In the Southern Conference. And I think in the documentary, there was a friend of mine, Lauren Biggers, who was like the assistant SID. And she said, like, if you wanted to watch him play, you couldn't watch the games on TV. You had to watch him like on live stream or be there in person. And then you could just, you could just sort of feel the energy when he got the ball, right? And it's magnified now, but when he would shoot, like, people would go crazy. And I remember the game at Madison Square Garden when we played West Virginia, and there was a kid who had played for me at Blair, this kid Wellington Smith, and then who else did they have? They had a kid who was like supposed to be a high draft pick, but they were good, right? And there's Bob Huggins, and they were sort of known for like offensive rebounding, and like you should look up the stats of that game and look at the rebounding differential was, because it's like they would shoot the ball because nobody on their team could shoot, right? They would shoot the ball, and I don't think they were trying to make the shot. They were just
trying to get it up on the glass. Let's go get it, fellas.
Go get it. And like, it was one of those things where, as a coach, you're on the bench, and I always, I had the first seat. It's like, oh my God, like, we can't get a rebound. And like, somehow, like, at the end of that game, I forgot who was guarding, but he was like 6'7", long arms. He was guarding Steph, and Steph like made a move and shot a three over. Cause Steph was, I don't think he played well that game. He just happened to make shots at the end of the game, and we ended up beating him. So every once in a while I'll send Wellington clips of that game, but that was the first time where like, you kind of knew, cause Coach McKillop always talked about like sort of playing under the Broadway lights, right? Because he's from New York City. He's like, the guys who I love are the ones who step up in those pressure situations. And in that moment, right, and in Madison Square Garden, because we always used to go to New York because that's where Coach was from over the winter break. But like in that moment, seeing him, the way he played, the way he like willed us to win that game, against a team who was way more talented than we were, right? We had no business winning that game. But like when he got the ball, like people were going crazy, just anticipating like what he was going to do. And I think Jay Billis was calling the game. It was just an unbelievable atmosphere, but just, there was so many moments like that. Like we played Chattanooga. He had like a 75 foot shot against them in the half, stuff like that. Like he just would do stuff that like, you know, it just seemed like he wasn't human, right? But like, again, but then he would come back and he'd just be like, he's just one of the guys, right? And I always appreciated that, because I always joke around, like if I had played the way he played his sophomore year and carried the team to like almost getting to the Final Four, like you wouldn't be able to talk to me, right? I would be just big time to people.
Doing your thing.
I want to get to the point where I could big time people even to this day. I don't think I'll ever be like that. But, so.
Nah, that's, I mean, obviously when you start talking about what it takes to get to the level that Steph has gotten to, I mean, I think you hit on it, right? He had an unbelievable amount of talent, but he also worked harder than anybody else, regardless of whether they had more talent, less talent, whatever. And you combine having the talent with having the work ethic. And that's when you get guys who achieve to the highest level of whatever their potential is. I mean, there's guys who don't get to that level that Steph's gotten because their talent isn't quite as high.
Yeah.
But you're talking about somebody who's maximizing who they can be, right? They're reaching the potential of what they were given because of their work ethic. And that's really how you end up getting to the level of success that Steph has clearly gotten to. And for you to be able to spend, you know, firsthand, be able to sit side by side with that is just, I'm sure that there's lessons that you've taken from him and stories that you've taken from him that you're able to incorporate into, you know, what you do on a daily basis, as far as having conversations with players and trying to get them to live up to their potential. I know that for you, the opportunity to go back to Andover as a head coach and leave college basketball, just from reading a little bit about you, that wasn't necessarily the easiest decision, because you had kind of had your mindset on, hey, I'm going to stay in the college basketball space. And then this opportunity in Andover comes your way. Talk a little bit about the decision to leave Colgate, take the Andover job, and then what it meant to you to kind of come back to a place that had been so special to you as a player.
Yeah, I loved working. It was only 1 year, because, you know, being at Davidson for 3 years, I was familiar with that place. I was close to home. So that was nice. And you know, being able to, you know, be a part of that community again was really special. So the journey to Colgate for me was a big leap, right? But I also had a good conversation with Matt Langle before I decided to take that job, and really respected him and wanted to just help him build something at Colgate. And you know, I sort of took that leap, which was, it was scary, right? Leaving home, going to a place that I wasn't really familiar with. But like I had a really good experience there. And there's the only reason I would have left Colgate, the only reason I would have left college coaching, was to come to Andover. And part of it was just I had such a good experience as a student at the school. I knew what the school had done for my older brother. I was still pretty close to the AD at the time. His name is Leon Modesty. And not only was he when I was a student, he was my college basketball. He was my, not college basketball. He was my basketball coach. He was my football coach. And he was also my house counselor. So I got to know him really well, and I had stayed in touch with him. And he would always talk to me about coming back at some point. But I knew he was going to like be here forever, because people come to these places, and because it's so amazing, they never leave. Right. And they don't have a reason to. But he and I stayed in touch. And at one point, I had looked at a job at another school, sort of similar to this, and he basically, and I was going to take the job. And he was like, don't do it. He's like, I want you to take my job at some point. And I was like, when? He was like, I don't know. Right. And he's just like, just trust me, be patient. And so that was like 2 or 3 years before, you know, I looked at and decided to come back to Andover. And so when he called me and said, hey, I'm going to coach football, I'll let you take over the basketball, to me, it was like a no brainer. And I had worked at Blair Academy, and one of the, you know, I didn't, the first year I got paid like $15,000. Right. But I ate for free on campus, and they gave me an apartment. So I was able to make it work. And so it was sort of similar here. They just were going to pay me a little bit more money. But I would have came for free, right? Because I knew what Coach Modesty did for me. I knew how much he helped me out. And like, part of the reason why I decided to leave college coaching is I loved that, being a part of that. But I didn't feel like I wanted to like help kids out in a different way. And at the college level, like, you get to know the kids really well, but like you weren't involved in their life as much outside of basketball. because it's a business, right? Whereas at Andover, it's not a business, right? You're here, like, I'm a basketball coach. I work in admissions. I'm a house counselor. I teach what we call an EBI class, empathy, balance, and inclusion class. And it's just a health / life skills class. So I get to know these kids really well. And I get to know kids who don't even play basketball really well. And like, for me, a kid from North Carolina, you know, coming from like a middle, lower class family, you know, the same reason why my mom wanted me to take advantage of this opportunity, right? I get to help kids like me, who probably even worse off than me, like use this opportunity to change the trajectory of their life, right? And to me, and Coach McKillop at Davidson always used to talk about, and he sort of used it in a basketball context, but it was more than just basketball. Like, one of his things was like, if you help somebody, you help yourself, right? He always used to say that. And so that meant like, if you set a screen, you're going to get somebody open. But if you get somebody open, guess what? You're going to get open, right? So like, if you help somebody get open, that means you're going to get open. You help yourself, right? If you take a charge, right? Like, you're going to help the team, right? You get credit for the charge, but you're helping the team. You always used to talk about that, but I know for a fact it wasn't just about basketball, right? And so this idea of being selfless, and helping other people was always something that Coach McKillop sort of drilled into us. So I love coaching, and it was something that I wanted to do, but coming to a school like Andover, being able to not only coach, but also help kids, in other ways, especially since I know what this place does for people, was like a dream for me. I love working for Coach Langle, and I think he's one of the best coaches in the country. But this was the only place that I would stop. I would like leave Colgate for, leave college coaching for. And I've been here for 13 years. I feel like I've made the right decision. But I also realized telling Coach Langle, like, that's how I knew I really wanted to do this, because telling him that I wanted to take this job was really difficult because of how much I cared about him, right? And you know, everything that he did for me. So
talk a little bit about, as you're describing the relationships that you're building with your players, and you're talking about the influence that you can have on kids, not only on the basketball floor, but off the basketball floor. Tell us a little bit about your role and how you see it in terms of helping the kids on your team get to college, whether that's kids who want to play and are able to play college basketball, or I'm sure you've had players on your team that aren't interested in playing college basketball, or maybe they're not good enough to play college basketball, and they're just going to be making a decision about where they're going to spend the next 4 years of their life in terms of academics and just going to school. So what's your role there, and how do you handle that with helping kids with the recruiting process and making a college decision?
Yeah. So I always think about like coaching is like teaching, but like it's a little bit different of a classroom. Right. And I think there are a lot of similarities, but with coaching, there's some lessons that I think I can help kids learn that teachers in the academic setting can't help their kids learn. Right. And I think about, helping kids learn how to compete, helping kids sort of learn how to deal with adversity, helping kids learn how to be have good sportsmanship, helping kids understand how to, like, because things aren't going to always work out the way you want them to, right? And that's just the way basketball. Coach McKillop, again, always just say, you know, basketball is a game of mistakes, right? So part of, you know, one of the things I try to do really well is help our kids do a really good job of learning from their mistakes, right? And because I coached at the college level, because I played at the college level, and not just played and coached at the college level, I played for one of the most well-respected coaches, you know, that has ever been involved in college basketball. And so I'm able to sort of pass along a lot of the lessons that I learned from him and some of the other people that I work with and work for, to my kids. And part of that is putting them in position, right, to understand what it's like to play at the next level. And so I try to run my practices. I try to, as just like they do at the college level. And so when kids, if they are lucky enough to play at the next level, as D3, D2, D1, junior college, anything like that, like when they go to practice, they say, coach, they've seen this before, right? They've experienced that intensity level. And so I try to sort of do a really good job of sort of simulating like what it would be like at the next level and giving them an idea of what to expect. So they're as prepared as possible to be successful as soon as possible once they step onto a college, like they go to these colleges and they're playing, and sort of helping them understand what the expectations are, what it's like to be a student athlete at this place, is how to manage your time, how to put yourself in a position to be successful, and that starts with like preseason, right? If our guys only start working when the season starts, then it's too late. And so we have like a fall program, and then it's a little bit different, right? In college is mandatory. But it wasn't necessarily the case before I got here, but the expectation here is like, if you're not playing a fall sport, right? Cause we have trimesters, it's fall, winter, and spring, and basketball here is a winter sport. But in the fall, like we have a program, and they know what that program is before they decide to come here. And I say to them, like, if you want to play at the next level, like this is what you have to do in order to get to that level. And there are no guarantees, but like, if you really want to play at this level, this is what you have to do. This is the work you have to put in. This is the type of commitment that you have to have. And so, we play pickup twice a week. I'm lucky enough here where there's a weightlifting class that our guys can be a part of. They lift four times a week. They lift on Monday, Tuesday, Thursday, and Friday. And they can do that, or they can do yoga and lift on their own, but if they're not playing a fall sport, like they have to be involved in some type of physical activity. And I have a 2-year-old now, so it's a little bit more difficult, but luckily my wife loves me. So if a kid comes to me and says, hey coach, I want to work out, right? I tell them, like, just text me, right? I want to work out. And what I'll say now, because when I was younger, I do like 4 individual workouts, right? And I wouldn't care, right, before I got married. But now it's like, hey, can you ask like 3 other people so we can only do like 2 instead of 4 individual workouts? But we get up at, we work out at like 6:15 in the morning. So I can be back to help my 2-year-old eat breakfast, right? But like, we'll get up in the morning, we'll work out, and then they'll do what they have to do and go to class, or we'll work out in the afternoon. But like, I love that, right? To me, as a coach, right, helping my kids get better, and helping them sort of reach their goals and their dreams is everything. And because at some point, some of our kids go and play at the next level. And eventually I think they appreciate all the work that they've done to prepare themselves when they actually get to that level. And they'll say, they'll come back and one of the things I try to create a program, right? And that just means like this sort of continuity with where the older kids who graduate are still connected to the kids who are currently at the school. And they're able to tell them, like, listen, this is what we did and this is why it's important to do this stuff. And like, if you really want to do this, right, this is what you got to do in order to be prepared. And to me, that's really important. I love that about, especially at North Mech, it's hard to have like a connection with kids who went to the school before, but at a place like this, that's sort of baked in, where kids have access to the alum and things like that. And so I try to, help our kids like communicate as much as possible with like the older guys who came through the program and who get a chance to appreciate why all the work that they put in is paying off.
Yeah. So, that legacy stuff is huge, man. When you start thinking about building the program that can have the type of success that you've been able to have and that you want to continue to have, because players who are in the program now see that, hey, this is what it took to get us here to where we are. And then the guys who have already gone through the program could say, hey, if you want to take this program to even higher heights, these are the things that we did, and these are the things that you have to do. And then obviously, as you build that network, you build those relationships between current players and former players, and it just kind of all cycles through on itself and has just a positive impact all the way around for everybody who's involved in the program. We're coming up close to an hour and a half, but before we get done, I know I want to ask you a little bit about the accident that you had in 2019 that I know from just doing some reading that clearly, as you'll probably be able to talk about here, it kind of changed your perspective and made you really think about what it was that you were doing. So maybe just give us the short story of the accident. And then after you tell that story, I'll jump back in with one final two-part question to wrap things up.
Yeah. It's to me, it's one of those things where, I just value life so much more now. You know, based on the adversity that I faced, and I didn't do it, but I will do it because I wanted to reach out to Coach McKillop, and just say thank you. Right. Cause he was tough on us in a good way. I talked about how he sort of using basketball, he prepared us for like life and all the sort of things that we would face long after the ball stopped bouncing. So 3 years ago, I was, because of the life that I've lived, I've had so many opportunities in the relationships and things like that. But, you know, part of working at this place is like, I get to sort of help people understand what this place is and travel and talk about this place and help people apply to the school as an admissions officer. I had the opportunity to go to China. So I was there for at least a month, and loved it. Right. It was amazing experience because it's just so different from, anything that I've, you know, done before that. And I think this is my second time going there. And my mom is always like, she's like, you're in China, right? Like she, you know, she cries, right? Happy tears because right. She's like, I never thought like my baby would be in China. Right. I'm spending time over there doing some work and you know, doing some like mock interviews and talking about the school and things like that. It was 3 years ago. I always feel like I'm way younger than I actually am. Right? Like
that's good, man. I feel the same way.
Yeah, I love me. I like laughing. I like smiling. I joke around, maybe a little bit too much and something. But like, I'm not like a. I know how to be serious. I know when to be serious. But that's not like my thing. Like that's not my strength, right? And so, you know, I was in China and but like that jet lag is no joke. So I flew back from China on maybe the 25th. I took time off. Like you would get like a certain amount of days to take off. So I took days off to go over there. Flew back and we have this program on our campus it's called ACE9 at the time, but it's basically a program where we bring kids that we admitted to the school, and it's a transition program. And it's a certain type of kid, a certain profile. But the idea is to help them get acclimated to the school before the year starts. And so they're here for 5 weeks. And like I help choose those kids. And so like I try to connect those kids and make sure that they know that like I'm there for them when they actually come, when school starts in September. So this program is in July. We had a dinner for them, right? So I flew back from China and I sort of like acted like, okay, I'm back, right? I gotta go to work, right? And part of that is because I love my job, right? And I love what I do. And so it never feels like work. So all it was just a dinner. And I live on campus 5 minutes from my office. So I walked in my office and we try to get them like, it was like I had the school credit card. So I bought them like a nice meal. We ate and we talked and they asked a lot of questions. And so we did that. And then I actually don't remember what I did after that. But I remember, I don't know where I was or anything like that. Cause I didn't lose my memory, not like long-term memory, but like that night is still a blur. But I was driving. And I think there's a statistic that says like, you know, a lot of accidents happen, like, you know, within like a certain radius of your house, but I was literally right up the street. Like I run by the place where I got in the accident, all the time. So I fell asleep because like my body just shut down. Right. Cause it's a 13 hour difference. So my body just shut down. So I fell asleep, and ended up hitting a tree. And so what I learned later on was that I was in the car unconscious for at least an hour because the house that I crashed in front of has a camera. And so that camera sees when my car hits the tree. And then it sees the car still there until like the emergency people, the ambulance and all that stuff arrived to help me out. And there are a lot of different stories, but what I keep hearing is that eventually they got to me, they got me out of the car. And we live close to a town called Lawrence, which is like the next town over. And there's a hospital that, when our kids need to go to the hospital, that's the closest one. And so I think they took me to Lawrence, and I don't remember any of this, but they took me to Lawrence, and the people at the Lawrence, because of the injuries I sustained, were like, we can't help him. Like, you got to get him to like Boston. And luckily there's a lot of good hospitals, in the Boston area. So, I always joke around. I flew in a helicopter for the first time. So they transported me from Lawrence in a helicopter to right out. It's a Tufts hospital right outside of Boston. So I got to Tufts. I flew in a helicopter, but I don't know if I actually flew in a helicopter because I wasn't aware that I flew in a helicopter. So I still, like, if anybody's listening wants to, like, put me in a helicopter, I'm happy to accept that. But they flew me to Tufts in a helicopter. I was there. I was in ICU for an unconscious and, like, basically in a coma for about, you know, 3-4 days. Ended up spending like 3 months in that hospital, and then had to do about 3 months in a inpatient like rehab facility, just learning how to walk, doing physical therapy, speech therapy, and occupational therapy. So what ended up happening when I got in a car accident, So I broke my ankle, but like nobody cares about that because the more serious injury was I hit my head so hard that they had to remove part of my skull. So they did a procedure called a craniotomy where if they hadn't removed part of my skull, my brain would have swelled up to the point where like it would have hit my skull and I would have died. Right. And so that's the procedure that the Lawrence Hospital couldn't do that. That's why they flew me to Tufts. And so when I woke up in the hospital, there's some crazy pictures. But when I woke up in the hospital, like I could basically like imagine not having like what we call a skull flap or a brain flap, right, on one side of your head, like it's just soft to the touch, right, in a very weird way. And so at that time, I was like, am I going to be like this for the rest of my life, right? But like the first time I talked to a doctor, I think that was the first question. I was like, can you fix my head, right? and the answer was yes. But what I do have now is like a really cool scar, right? And it's I always joke around. It's a part of my story, but it's a really cool scar. But eventually, so 3 months later, that part of my skull was stored in a special freezer, a bone freezer, and they sort of reattached that, and I have. Using titanium screws. So it's reattached to my head, but I still had that cool scar. But then I had to spend at least 3 more months in an outpatient rehab facility, just learning how to like walk and like do occupational therapy and speech therapy and stuff like that. Like I had to sort of learn how to speak again and do a lot of memory stuff. And it was like one of those experiences where I'm glad I went through all the adversity I had, including losing my father, right? And sort of dealing with that, but also, you know, playing basketball and learning lessons. But like it was tough. It was scary. But I had so many people who were looking out for me, including the people who were a part of this Andover community, which I'm so thankful for, but also like, you know, so many people reached out. So many people figured out how to help. People were cooking me meals, right? I gained so much weight because I was laying in bed a lot, but I could eat, right? But like, you know, it was to me, I've never thought about it as a net negative thing, right? Like I'm so much better, I think. Because I went through that experience and like, it just shows that like, I have every reason to be thankful about like the community that I have, the friends that I have. And, you know, it was scary. Right. But the fact that I'm alive, the fact that I'm doing well. And so I think, in that November, so that I got in an accident in July. In November, I was back coaching, and I was trying to get into the gym.
That's incredible.
I was trying to get into the gym to coach my kids. So because I didn't have a part of my skull, I had to wear like this really Like, and again, like, I had to wear a helmet, right? Because if I got hit in the head, like, they were like, you could die, right? If you get hit in the head. And so I'm sneaking in the gym trying to like, do workouts, right? And then she's my neighbor, my AD. She worked with me in admissions. She was the AD at the time. And like, she, not only did she like, because she cared about me, but she's like, if I see you in the gym, right? Like, that was like, she scared me, right? Because she said, like, you cannot do this.
Right.
And you think you're caring about these kids by being in, because I needed that, right? I needed to be in the gym. And I felt like I was letting my kids down, right? And they didn't feel like that, right? They didn't feel like that. But I was just like, I need to be in the gym, right? Because, like, who's going to work them out, right? Who's going to call the college coaches to come watch them play? Who's going to do all this stuff? And I was like, I got to be in the gym. And I'm in there with a helmet with like on crutches because I can't walk, and like trying not to get caught because I knew I wasn't supposed to be in there. And like, eventually my AD saw me, and she used some strong words to say she better not find me in the gym. And then she followed up with an email, and she CC'd my mom. So it was like,
went right to the source.
Yeah, it's like, all right, so I can't be in the gym. But I was back coaching in November, right? And like, to me, like, that was everything, because like, that sort of became, I had a lot of purposes, but like, I wanted to fight as much as I, as hard as I can to get back to the point where I could be with like that part of my family, right? My kids. And then the other thing I would say is like, I also, again, like I had played for Coach McKillop. I had dealt with like him making me tougher. And you know, so I knew I was going to be okay. Right. I thought I was going to be okay. Like there was doubt at times, but, it's a part of my story, and I am very thankful that I'm still alive. And it makes me want to do everything I can to sort of reinforce what Coach McKillop said. Like, I want to continue to help people, right? I feel like I'm here for a reason, and in order, because I'm here, I I'm in this position, I can help people out. So, and people hearing that story, I think it matters. I think. Because they know how like extraordinary it is that I'm still alive, right? I'm still breathing.
Yeah, that's an incredible story. Yeah. I mean, it really is when you look at what you went through, and then to be able to bounce back, not only fully bounce back from it, but bounce back from it as fast as you were able to. It's pretty incredible. Let's wrap up with one final two-part question. So part one is, when you think ahead in the next year or two, what do you see as being your biggest challenge? And then part two of the question is, when you think about what you get to do every day, what brings you the most joy? So your biggest challenge and then your biggest joy.
Ooh, biggest challenge. That's a great question. The greatest joy is, I talked about this a lot, but it's just seeing the kids that I work with, especially the basketball players, but also the other kids that don't play basketball that I'm able to develop relationships with, like seeing them do well. But also seeing them not do well and working their way through it. Right. Happiness is something that I think is really important, but that doesn't mean that you're like, everything's okay all the time. Right. And I think in order to be happy, you got to be able to deal with the tough times. Right. And sort of develop coping mechanisms and be able to self-reflect. So helping kids sort of understand that and seeing them grow and learn, and do amazing things, right? That brings me so much joy. The biggest challenge, man, that's a good question. Um, What's the biggest challenge? Maybe it's because I'm so lucky, right? I don't necessarily see, because when I think about the school, right, this place is amazing, but it's not perfect. But I don't look at it that way. I look at it as an opportunity for our school, our community to get better. So the biggest challenge I would say is I don't know.
Looking for ways to get better at what you're already doing, I think is what I hear you saying.
Yeah, I guess so. That's a tough question for me because I see challenges as things that help me get better, right? Help me learn and help me put myself in a position to overcome something, right? The life I lived, I know things aren't going to always be great, right? I think back to losing my father, right? I think about him all the time, and it makes me sad sometimes that he's not here to play with my 13-year-old daughter, to see my 2-year-old, or to meet my wife. But I also know, I learned a lot. I grew a lot from sort of dealing with losing him and understanding how I had to step up to be more responsible and help take care of my family. Cause my brother was away when he passed away. Right. And it was just me and my mom. And so being there for her and us getting closer because of what happened to him. And this may seem a little cheesy, but I actually appreciate challenges. Right. So I try not to see them as challenges as much as just opportunities, I would say, I guess.
Yeah, no, that makes complete sense. All right. Yeah. Before we wrap up, I want to give you a chance to share how people can find out more about you, your program, if you want to share social media, website, email, whatever you feel comfortable with. And then after you do that, I will jump back in and wrap things up.
Yeah, I can do that. I got to get better. That's a challenge. I got to get better at using social media. I would say Instagram. It's TEIvory1981. That's my Instagram handle. And to learn more about the school, www.andover.edu. If I can help you out, please let me know. But my email address is tivory@andover.edu. So, that's what I have.
Yeah, I can't thank you enough for taking the time out of your schedule tonight to jump on with us. Really, really appreciate it. It's been a lot of fun. We touched on a wide range of different things that impacted you throughout your career. And again, I can't thank you enough for sharing all that with us. So appreciate that. And to everyone out there, thanks for listening. And we will catch you on our next episode. Thanks. Your first impression is everything when applying for a new coaching job. A professional coaching portfolio is the tool that highlights your coaching achievements and philosophies, and most of all, helps separate you and your abilities from the other applicants. The Coaching Portfolio Guide is an instructional membership-based website that helps you develop a personalized portfolio. Each section of the Portfolio Guide provides detailed instructions on how to organize your portfolio in a professional manner. The guide also provides sample documents for each section of your portfolio that you can copy, modify, and add to your personal portfolio. As a Hoopheads Pod listener, you can get your Coaching Portfolio Guide for just $25. Visit coachingportfolioguide.com/hoopheads to learn more.
Thanks for listening to the Hoopheads Podcast, presented by Head Start Basketball.